at least if you're Keegan Randall, you know you're standing next to a possible gold medal winner here today. You'll know where you stand in the competition from the very beginning.
Keegan Randall goes toe-to-toe with the best cross-country skiers in the world. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 17th of February. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, an Anchorage killer is sentenced.
I don't remember two homicides that have ever been such open wounds in the community of Anchorage as these two.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ACS. With Android on ACS, an app is available to listen to NPR programming on your phone. Complete details at acsalaska.com.
Keegan Randall took eighth today in the cross-country classic sprint at the Olympics. She fell short of the medal she was hoping for, but still managed to make history. Eighth is the best finish for an American woman in cross-country skiing at the Olympics. Randall fought hard on the course today. She spent much of her quarterfinal heat in fourth place, but charged ahead at the end. The NBC announcers called the action in the final stretch.
But now the sprint for second spot. Astrid Jakobsen is being closed down a bit by Randall and Perale of Finland.
Right now it's Norway, one and two.
Here comes Randall on the outside. It may not be second, but remember there's a lucky loser spot to move on to. Oh, Randall's trying to take it from Jakobsen too, but it's not going to be enough.
She will miss by about 6 feet and finish 4 seconds back of Bjergen's time.
Randall ended up in third for her heat and made it to the semifinals. She placed fourth in that round and didn't move on to the finals. The sprint is Randall's best event, but she specializes in the skate ski technique. This year's Olympic sprint race is only in the classic technique. Anchorage skier Holly Brooks also competed today, placing 38th. The gold medal went to Marit Bjørgen of Norway. Justinia Kowalczyk of Poland got silver, and Petra Medic took bronze for Slovenia. This morning in an Anchorage Superior Courtroom, Joshua Wade pleaded guilty to the murders of Mindy Schloss and Della Brown. In the afternoon, Wade basically repeated a similar pre-process in federal court. Before receiving the maximum sentence allowed under state law and a life sentence in federal court, Wade heard from the friends and family members of Brown and Schloss, who described pain that even today's judgment can't heal. KSKA's Len Anderson attended both proceedings.
My name is Kirak Fells, and I am the baby sister of Della Marie Brown.
Fells was one of over a half dozen people who spoke before the sentencing. After Wade was acquitted in the 2003 slaying of her sister and was released in 2006 for tampering with evidence in the case, Fells moved to Illinois. Speaking long distance, she described a loss greater than any sentencing could heal.
Shortly after I got to Illinois, my mom had told me that Mindy was killed by Joshua Wade. Even though I didn't know Mindy, I cried so hard as if she was part of my family. I don't think anybody understands what Joshua Wade had done to us, Della's and Mindy's family, what we had to go through.
Wade broke into the home of Mindy Schloss, a nurse psychologist, and his neighbor in early August 2008. He bound her and forced her to reveal her ATM PIN number. He then used Schloss's car to take her to a wooded cul-de-sac near Wasilla, where he killed her. Brown's brother, James Britton, asked both courts for the maximum punishment and no parole.
I ask you to do everything in your power to prevent him from harming another woman or their family again. It would be unconscionable and morally indefensible for anyone else to suffer as our family has had to the last many years.
Schloss's longtime friend Robert Conway saw prison as extracting the pain upon Wade that he inflicted on his two victims.
Your Honor, I'm here looking for some justice. I'm hoping that this court can do everything possible under the laws to make this defendant's life as tough as possible. He's not tough enough to face the trial and the chance of the death penalty, but in a way that would be too. I will sleep better knowing that once this idiot is in the general population in prison, that he will understand what tough grit is. This defendant will get a trial by his peers because they're in prison with him, and I hope to hell he feels the fear he has inflicted on others.
In both courts, Joshua Wade spoke as well.
I don't expect forgiveness from any of you. I don't deserve it. I am doing this with nothing to do with the death penalty. Today is not about me. It's about you, and it's about my family.
Wade's agreement to plead guilty to the two first-degree murder charges eliminated a federal trial in the Mindy Schloss killing and the threat of the death penalty. In the morning state session, Wade was contrite. In his afternoon federal appearance, he began that way as well. In both, he said despite any abuse he suffered as a child and addictions he embraced, he had chosen not to take the counseling opportunities offered. But when federal judge Ralph Beislein began to describe him as a heartless, selfish, bully, and coward, Wade suddenly burst out, "Don't push it, Judge. I owe these people and my family an apology, not you." "I will push it," responded the judge. "We know about the women you killed. What about the men?" shot back Wade with no further explanation. At the conclusion of the sentencing, Beislein said, "I think the anger Mr. Wade just displayed may be the last thing Mindy Schloss saw." Wade will serve the rest of his life in prison with no possibility of release in either sentence, a sentence Judge Volan said will also provide some closure for the entire community.
"I don't remember two homicides that have ever been such open wounds in the community of Anchorage as these two. Many and all of us here have struggled to wonder how and why and to try and make some sense out of two absolutely senseless murders."
Wade will serve his sentence within the Alaska State Prison System. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The Elizabeth Paratrovich Day Parade that passed through Sitka on Tuesday included a new addition, a totem pole sculpted by Tommy Joseph and commissioned by the U.S. Census Bureau. That's right, the Census Bureau. KCAW's Ed Ronco has details.
When the Census Bureau first approached Sitka artist Tommy Joseph to build a totem pole, he says he started wondering.
"What do they want a totem pole for? What do they want it to say? What story? What are we telling?"
And when do they need it? The answer? Soon. Joseph says usually a pole that size takes a couple months. This one was done in 15 days. The pole will travel around Alaska, then go to Washington State for a while, before being put on display in Washington, D.C. It depicts an eagle, a raven, and a human.
That's in the Tlingit culture, you're born under the eagle or raven moiety, and so we're covering all people, and there's a human with a robe, and on the robe are hands all different colors, representing people being counted.
And that helps answer Joseph's first question. What does the United States Census Bureau want with the totem pole?
"We haven't always done the best job of getting the message out to the Alaska Natives about the importance of the census."
Jan McStay is the Assistant Regional Manager for the Census Bureau in Seattle.
"We believe that creating a pole that signifies the importance of the census to the Alaska Native population might be the best way to convey that message."
The pole was unveiled during Sitka's Elizabeth Paratrovich Day Parade. Jerry Hope, president of the Alaska Native Brotherhood Camp No. 1, says the Census Bureau and Paratrovich have something in common. They both wanted people to be counted. Paratrovich fought for Native rights, most notably during testimony in front of the Alaska legislature. That testimony is often credited with ensuring the passage of a law banning discrimination in Alaska. Hope says it's important to commemorate Paratrovich's contributions, but also those of all the leaders along the way who fought for, promoted, and raised awareness for Native rights.
"I know that Elizabeth Paratrovich would be one of the first to say, hey, wait a minute, don't just recognize me, recognize all the others who did so much."
The attendees at Tuesday's Elizabeth Paratrovich Day program heard a reading of the names of those leaders, and some of them, like Isabella Brady, reflected on a time before they had many rights at all. She remembers having to clear off the sidewalk if a white person was trying to pass, or being ignored in stores once a white customer walked in.
And the worst thing that ever happened, we were walking by where the Columbia Bar is. I was walking with a friend. I think I was in about the fourth or fifth grade, and there were two white boys coming one way. We were walking the other way. They had a dog with them, and one of them said, "Sick 'em." That dog jumped up and bit her on the throat.
Brady is now president of the Alaska Native Sisterhood Camp Number 1. She says back when she was a girl, she never would have imagined the improvements made in the years since. Although, she says there are still things that could be different.
Who are here today? The Mount Edgecombe students? This was declared a legal holiday by the legislators and the city schools and were not let out. Is there something wrong with that picture? I don't know. I have a lot of questions. I have more questions than I do have answers, but we're going in the right direction. I think we have health care, we can vote, and the many different things that she was aspiring to. But there's still a long ways to go yet.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an underestimated dog breed in Mushing.
People say you can't do it with Siberians, that you can't be competitive, that you can't run them for any competitive speed, and I think it's not true.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
The state would take part in paying for school meals through a bill heading through the Senate this session. The measure by Anchorage Democrat Bill Wilikowski would provide an extra 35 cents for breakfasts and 15 cents for free or reduced price lunches for students from low-income families. The state input would be in addition to the $34 million in federal money that goes into the program statewide. Wilikowski told the Senate's Education Committee that the plan would have positive results for the state in students' performances, both long-term and short-term. And psychologist Mike Sobosinski told the panel studies link good nutrition with student success.
As children are not hungry and they are able to be in the classroom, that you do see an improvement in behavior. It's just very difficult to take care of business when you're not properly fed.
Amy Rouse, Director of Nutrition Services for the Fairbanks North Star Borough Schools, says 30% of the district students qualify for the free or reduced rate meals. The district is looking at a $300,000 shortfall this year, but won't cut back on quality or service.
In the month of January, we served over 27,000 breakfasts and 92,000 lunches. 28% of the breakfasts and 66% of the lunches were served to students who qualify to receive meals at the free or reduced rate.
Currently, schools meet the budget shortfalls in the cost of meals with money that was originally planned for classroom needs. The committee will take the bill back up on Friday with a cost estimate for the program to be provided by the Department of Education. A meeting was hosted by the Native Village of Unalakleet on Tuesday between Bering Sea Area tribes and the National Marine Fisheries Service to begin a dialogue about upcoming decisions that could affect Western Alaskans. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the story.
The National Marine Fisheries Service, also known as NMFS, is a federal agency that makes recommendations to the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, the decision-making body for the Bering Sea and Aleutian Island fisheries. Native Village of Unalakleet's environmental specialist Art Ivanov said they invited members from NMFS for consultation.
But also for us to play a more meaningful role in the process, because for the most part, tribes have been left out of the loop as it relates to the decision-making process.
Much of Tuesday's meeting in Unalakleet circled around the possible northern expansion of the bottom trawl fishery. Bottom trawling or flatfish trawling is currently not allowed north of St. Matthew Island, an area designated as the Northern Bering Sea Research Area. The National Marine Fisheries Service is planning to conduct research to drive any future decision-making regarding trawl fishing in the area that includes waters near St. Lawrence Island and the Norton Sound. Bottom trawlers drag cables or chains across the seafloor to sweep up flatfish like flounders. And although the trawl fishery is slowly incorporating technology to limit seafloor destruction, most trawlers still use traditional methods. Roughly 40 people were at the meeting, with representatives ranging from St. Lawrence Island, Elam, Koyuk, Shaktulik, Stebbins, St. Michael, Nome, and Unalakleet, along with three National Marine Fisheries Service representatives. Each tribal member opposed expanding the trawl fishery northward. Rose Fosdick of Kowarik, a regional nonprofit organization, voiced her concern regarding the possible fishery.
To me, it implied you'd already made a decision that this where we're heading is bottom trawling. So if you were to listen to some of the seal hunters and walrus hunters and crabbers and fishermen and bird hunters that go out to the marine environment, I think you would hear a lot of objections to allowing bottom trawling in our area.
Fosdick asked how information from hunters and fishermen would be used in the agency's research. Alaska Fisheries Science Center's Bill Karp said they're learning as they go along and haven't on a routine basis worked with information from indigenous people. NIMF's acting deputy regional director John Kurland added on.
I don't want people to get the foregone conclusion, well, you know, trawling's coming, it's going to be in that area. The council's trying to set up the management framework so that smart decisions can be made about if and when fishing will be allowed up in that area.
Many commented on the interconnectedness of marine resources. King Island hunter Sylvester Ayuk attended the meeting and expressed his concern regarding walrus hunting. Ayuk said 2 years ago he didn't see one walrus and only a small herd last year.
Now, if the bottom trawlers come in, I'm afraid, you know, that they will drastically disturb the feeding beds of the walrus that we depend on so much. And I would advise, you know, for this council to consider, you know, that there would be a 100-year ban, you know, of bottom trawlers in this area.
Many tribal representatives asked how they can get their concerns taken into serious consideration by the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. They cited last year's Chinook bycatch hard cap decision in the pollock fishery that a majority of Alaska Natives were dissatisfied with. Many felt ignored, although tribes and Native organizations wrote letters of concern and took part in public testimony. Their response from NIMS was to provide concern and comments early and to provide them often. The next North Pacific Fisheries Management Council meeting is scheduled for April 6th in Anchorage. The Northern Bering Sea Research Plan will come under review then. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinneen.
A hydropower project on the west side of Cook Inlet is gaining interest, but may rely on state funds to get off the ground. TDX Power, a subsidiary of St. Paul's Tanagusik's Native Corporation, has asked legislators for $5 million to further studies on the Chacachamna Hydro Plan. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission must first extend TDX's permit to study the project. Nick Goodman is director of TDX Power Services.
For about the last 6 months, we've been in discussions with the state looking to secure some more funding to keep the Chacachamna project moving forward. And we've also proposed that the project be developed in partnership with the state of Alaska.
The project is not a new idea. It was first proposed in the 1980s by the Alaska Power Authority. Goodman says TDX dusted off the project in 2006.
It's gaining a lot of attention now because gas is perceived to be expensive, and we have questions about how much of it there is. And Chacachamna looks to be a very attractive project, given the economics of power generation and the rail belt at this time. It's one that is not a slam dunk. It needs to be studied quite a bit more.
Goodman says if successful, Chacachamna could provide 1.5 billion kilowatt hours a year for the rail belt utilities. All hydro projects on navigable waters require a FERC permit. TDX has had a permit since 2006, but it expired after 3 years. Goodman says 3 years is not enough for preliminary studies. TDX has filed for a permit extension.
From our standpoint, it's appropriate to spend money to keep this project moving forward so that when a decision is made, the project is shovel-ready, if you will, or ready to go.
TDX operates and constructs power plants around the state. The company is currently building a power plant at Fort Greely for the missile defense site.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Fort Yukon musher Josh Kadzo is the Yukon Quest Rookie of the Year. The 22-year-old, the only Alaska Native musher in this year's race, scratched in his first Quest attempt last year but crossed under the finish banner in Whitehorse yesterday afternoon as the 2010 Quest top rookie in seventh place. Kadzo struggled early in the Quest when he dropped several dogs, leaving the halfway point at Dawson City with eight of his original 14. Kadzo, who finished with seven dogs, said the small team performed well.
They just start coming together and things were just clicking and we start catching teams and now we're here, seventh place. They're happy, look at them. There's nothing wrong with them.
Kadzo says he worked all year to prepare for the Quest and that he's looking to improve again in next year's race. Kadzo battled Two Rivers musher Abby West for hundreds of miles for the top rookie spot, only moving ahead over the last couple of days of racing. West finished a strong ninth, the first woman to complete the 2010 race. Smooth trail and good weather have led to another record in the Yukon Quest. From member station KUAC, Dan Bross reports.
Two Rivers musher Mike Alice's team has broken the Yukon Quest speed record for Siberian Huskies, a mark he set with some of the same dogs in his rookie Quest run in 2008. Most racing mushers favor mixed breed Alaskan Huskies over the furrier, bigger Siberians, but Alice says the purebreds are capable of a lot more speed than people think.
People say you can't do it with Siberians, that you can't be competitive, that you can't run them for any competitive speed, and I think it's not true. I think there's not enough people trying, and that the dogs are better than most people give them credit for. And I mean, we just decided 5 years ago we were going to come run the Yukon Quest, and we bred two litters, and nine of them, those dogs started this race, and their parents, and, you know, we didn't go through a million dogs to get here.
Ellis's under 11-day time lops over 30 hours off the Siberian Quest speed record he set in 2008. Ellis, who finished with 11 dogs, is one of two mushers running all Siberians in this year's Quest. Ellis says he's proud that Swiss rookie musher Pierre-Antoine Ertier is following in his footsteps.
He thanked me at the start banquet for making him think it was possible. So if I can inspire some other people to come out here and try it with dogs that they didn't think necessarily could do it, that's good by me.
RTA was running in 21st place this afternoon, less than 200 miles from the finish line with 12 dogs. With help from Fairbanks Daily Newsminer reporter Josh Armstrong on the Yukon Quest Trail, I'm Dan Bross in Fairbanks.
Despite unseasonably warm weather that turned streets into a slushy mess and economic problems that almost put it on hold for a year, Homer residents turned out in droves to watch the 54th annual Homer Winter Carnival Parade, making this year's theme snow matter what, especially appropriate. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has the story.
The fun actually starts in the parking lot of Homer High School, about an hour or so before the parade begins its march down Pioneer Avenue. This is where all the parade marchers, dancers, musicians, float drivers, and assorted livestock gather to get ready for the big show. Joining longtime parade stalwarts like the Homer Ice Racing Association, the Girl Scouts, and the crew of Gambrinus Marching Band is the Homer News, whose publisher and chief float decorator, Lori Evans, says the idea to get involved was pretty spontaneous.
Somebody said we should have a float in the parade, and everybody agreed.
Graphic designer Deb Purington is the lucky person picked out to wear a giant, cumbersome-looking newspaper monster costume. The full-body outfit, which is fringed from top to bottom in clippings from the Homer News, was made by Christy Fry.
Well, you start with a paint suit, and then you take a whole lot of newspapers and cut them into strips, and a lot of glue and a lot of time.
Getting Purington into the suit proves to be a challenge.
Where's this foot go?
You always knew it, didn't you?
This has never been done before, so, you know, you got to give you a little slack there.
I'm not ticklish.
Okay, where's your...
At the head of the parade line, about a half a dozen or so ice racing vehicles, including one converted pickup truck with a cab stuffed full of adults and kids, are revving up for the start.
Are you guys ready for the parade?
Absolutely.
Yeah? Are you excited?
Yeah.
Have you ever done this before, been in the parade?
This is our first race, our first parade, yeah.
Okay. Well, don't crash into anybody.
We're going to try not to. A little bumper action going on.
About a dozen or so Girl Scout daisies are waiting patiently in the back of another truck. They're ready for the parade to get underway, too.
So what are you guys going to do in the parade?
Throw candy.
Really?
Have fun.
Girls, what are we going to do when the trailer stops?
We're gonna get up and sing to judges.
Good. Oh, really?
Good job. You guys want to sing it?
You want to sing it real fast?
Yes, I'm blue. I'm a little daisy. Yes, I'm blue. I'm a Girl Scout, so are you. When I go to meetings, to sing and shout, I love being a daisy Girl Scout.
If I was the judge, you guys would win.
And win they did. In front of a roaring crowd at the judges' stand, the Girl Scouts took home the judges' first choice prize, while the Homer News float won in the Best For-Profit category. Taking the award for Best Nonprofit and entertaining kids of all ages along the way with their colorful Mardi Gras-inspired costumes and loose arrangement of Got My Mojo Workin' was the crew of Gambrinus.
Ladies and gentlemen, the crew of Gambrinus!
In Homer, I'm Aaron Self.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.